Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Patent Litigation and Reverse Payments Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On March 25, 2013, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Federal Trade Commission v. Activists. This case involves so-called reverse payments made between brand-name drug manufacturers and their potential generic competitors. The brand-name manufacturer brings an action for patent infringement against the generic competitor, which defends by arguing that the generic product is not infringed and that the patent is invalid. To settle the litigation, the brand name manufacturer agrees to pay the generic competitor a large sum of money in exchange for the competitor's agreement to delay marketing of the generic drug for a period of years. The question in this case is whether such reverse payment agreements are per se lawful, assuming the underlying litigation was not a sham and that the patent was not obtained by fraud, or instead, presumptively anti-competitive and unlawful. To discuss the case, we have Dan Crane, who is a professor at the University of Michigan Law School. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Crane.
This is Dan Crane, professor of law at the University of Michigan, and I will be speaking about the FTC versus Activist Pharmaceuticals case. The case was originally thought of under the name of FTC versus Watson Pharmaceuticals, but Watson Pharmaceuticals changed its name to Activist in January, so that's the way in which the case will be decided. The issue that was argued in the Supreme Court this week is a multi-billion dollar issue involving the intersection of patent law, food and drug regulation under the FDA, and antitrust law. It's been one of the thorniest, most difficult questions in antitrust law for about the last 15 years or so, and there's been a huge amount of litigation and scholarship written over this very difficult question. The question, in short, is whether reverse payments or pay-for-delay settlements, which arise when patent litigation cases between a pioneer or branded drug company are settled on a basis where the branded company pays the allegedly infringing generic to stay off the market for some period of time, are legal or illegal under the antitrust laws. The Federal Trade Commission has taken the view that these settlements are presumptively illegal under the antitrust laws. They'd be illegal in most situations unless a particular legal test were met. There's a circuit split currently between the Sixth and Third Circuits that have held that these reverse payment settlements are per se illegal or almost per se illegal, and then the Second and Eleventh Circuits, which have adopted a much more permissive test under which the settlements are legal so long as they are within the exclusionary potential or scope of the patent. It's a really complicated question. And one of the things that the oral argument this week on Wednesday showed is that the justices are struggling not merely to figure out the right legal rule to announce in the case, but also just to understand the regulatory context and economics in which this question arises. Let me say a word about the statutory and regulatory backdrop to the question, which is pretty complicated, but creates some particular kinds of incentives and problems for the legal analysis in antitrust cases. The statutory backdrop is the Hatch-Waxman Act of 1984, which was meant to incentivize generic pharmaceutical companies to challenge the branded or pioneer company and enter the market more quickly than they had been doing. What Hatch-Waxman allows the generic to do is basically piggyback on the FDA approval of the branded firm under what's called an abbreviated new drug application, or ANDA, and basically by asserting bioequivalence to the branded drug, get FDA approval to enter the market without having to do its own separate clinical studies. The generic, though, has to make what's called a Part 4 certification, asserting that it doesn't infringe on the branded company's patents. Then the branded company has 45 days to file a patent infringement lawsuit. If it does, the generic's right to enter the market under the FDA regulations is stayed for 30 months or a judicial determination that the generic entry would not infringe the patent. So there's an automatic stay in place. That means the generics are typically not entering for a long time after filing their ANDA. Also, the first ANDA applicant is granted a 180-day period of exclusivity to market the generic, essentially as a bounty for being the first to get there. So there have been a number of these cases litigated, as I said before, and the fact patterns are all sort of idiosyncratic and somewhat different from each other. But the fact pattern at issue in this particular case, the Watson Pharmaceuticals case, is fairly representative of the way these cases have gone in terms of the underlying facts. So Solvay Pharmaceuticals has a patent and FDA approval for Androgel. Androgel is a topical gel containing synthetic testosterone, which is used to treat symptoms of low testosterone in men. The patent will expire in 2020. Soon after Solvay got its patent, two generics, Watson and Paddock, filed for ANDAs. And then, as is always the case, Solvay filed a patent infringement suit alleging that if they entered the market before 2020, they would be infringing on Solvay's patents. So the automatic stay under the Hatch-Waxman Act was in place for a period of time. Then the stay expired by virtue of the 30 months running, and the litigation was still ongoing. And then the FDA promptly approved Watson's ANDA, and the approval led Solvay to settle the case with the generics under terms where Watson, Paddock, and Androgel agreed that the generics would not enter the market until August 31st, 2015, so considerably longer in the future than they otherwise might have entered, but still 5 years before the expiration of the patent. Unless another generic manufacturer, entered the market before then. And they also agreed to provide Solvay with certain kinds of marketing and manufacturing assistance, which complicates the facts somewhat. In return, Solvay agreed to pay the generics millions of dollars in order to effectively not enter the market before 2015, and also for the manufacturing and marketing assistance. The FTC sued, alleging that the settlement agreement was basically an attempt to defer generic competition for Androgel by postponing the date of generic entry and thereby effectively maintaining Solvay's monopoly and allowing the parties to share in the monopoly profits at the expense of consumers. Importantly, the FTC's complaint hinged on an allegation that Solvay probably would have lost the underlying patent infringement lawsuit if the litigation had been played out to full fruition. And the complaint alleged that Solvay was not likely to prevail and that Watson and Paddock had developed very strong arguments and evidence that their use of the generic version of Androgel would not infringe the patents. The case eventually landed in the Northern District of Georgia, where the district court dismissed the case based on prior 11th Circuit precedent. The 11th Circuit had seen at least two prior patent infringement reverse payment cases as antitrust matters and had held in those cases that as so long as the settlement was within the exclusionary potential of the patent or scope of the patent, then the settlements were lawful. And so applying its prior precedents, then the 11th Circuit affirmed since the settlement was within the exclusionary scope of the patent, it was therefore lawful. And that sort of, again, reinforced the circuit split where other circuits had held that such settlements were close to per se illegal. In the Supreme Court, the FTC is asking the court to adopt a rule that these kinds of reverse payments are presumptively illegal. And essentially, the burden would be on the FTC, first of all, just to show that such a settlement with a reverse payment has occurred, and then the burden would shift to the defendants to justify the settlement in one of two ways. First, they could show that any consideration for something other than delay, so for example, if in the Watson case the payment was actually really for the manufacturing and marketing assistance, then that would be a sufficient rebuttal. Or the defendants in the antitrust case could rebut the presumption of illegality by showing that the payment was commensurate with litigation costs that the brand name or pioneer company would have avoided by settling the suit early. So that's the way in which the issue was presented to the Supreme Court. Based on the questions posed by the justices at Wednesday's oral argument, it seems unlikely that either side is going to get exactly what they want, although one would sort of, you know, reading the tea leaves, think that the FTC seems headed for the better result. The justices seemed very skeptical that any settlement within the exclusionary scope of the patent should be per se legal. So they seemed very, very skeptical that the 11th Circuit's test should stand, which would then mean that the decision of the 11th Circuit would be reversed and remanded. But they also seemed reluctant to adopt the FTC's presumptive illegality test. They seemed headed instead towards some kind of application of a fairly open-ended rule of reason, which applies to most kinds of agreements that are potentially anti-competitive. And under this rule of reason analysis, they would allow inquiry into the kinds of allegations that the FTC made in its complaint in this case, such as the strength of the patent claim. Was the strength of the patent claim such that the patent infringement lawsuit by the Pioneer Company likely would have failed in the event that the case had been litigated all the way out, the patent case? Now, that outcome would, in my view, be the theoretically correct one. I've written a fair amount about this, and I think that's theoretically correct. It would, though, pose a daunting practical problem of implementation. Asking jurors in antitrust cases to assess the merits of a patent infringement case that the parties themselves have settled and therefore are no longer in a position to really provide accurate information about, since they have incentives on both sides to say that the case would have been successful for the patentee, the branded company, that creates real problems of implementation and uncertainty. And it's unclear how that would actually be implemented if this were played out on remand. Another issue that I've written about fairly extensively is that this whole focus on the direction in which the payment flows, the reverse payment or pay for delay idea, is really overly narrow. So one can have licenses to generics from pioneer companies where money flows from the generic to the branded company in the, you know, the usual way as a settlement would flow. But those settlements can be just as anti-competitive as the reverse payment settlements. So, for example, if the branded company makes the generic its authorized generic distributor, and then the generic pays essentially the monopoly rent back to the branded company as its sort of its payment to the branded company for that right, then the economic effect is virtually identical to the generic staying off the market altogether. So it seems to me that if this issue is going to be resolved in a comprehensive way, then what we'll discover over time is that any rule that focuses specifically on the specific direction in which compensation flows in a patent infringement settlement is going to be really both over-inclusive and under-inclusive. So I see it as really doubtful that the Supreme Court's decision in this case is going to put the issue to rest. An open-ended rule of reason analysis, which is the suggestion that came up in the oral argument, will simply sort of kick these issues back down to the lower courts without any real guidance for comprehensive resolution. There has been an effort over the last 10 or so years in Congress to come up with a statutory framework that would in some ways resolve these questions, and it's my guess is that Congress is where these questions will ultimately be resolved.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.